Hello and welcome to the Spike podcast. I'm Fraser Myers, delighted to be joined as ever by Spike's editor, Tom Slater.
Hello.
And returning extra special guest, writer and comedian, Andrew Doyle.
Hello.
Thanks so much for coming on, Andrew. We've got loads to talk about today. We'll be discussing the landmark Supreme Court ruling on gender, how the British state enabled the Abedi family, and we'll talk to you, Andrew, about some of your post-GB News life and activities in America. So the Supreme Court has handed down an extraordinary ruling. It seems extraordinary because it's so common sense and we're so starved of common sense in our world at the moment. It's basically said that sex is biological, meaning that trans women are not women. This is absolutely seismic. It probably shouldn't be, but it is considering the context. Andrew, do you want to unpack it a bit for us?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you hear this for the first time, you think, why on earth is the Supreme Court ruling on what a woman is and what biological sex is? But it does really matter. And the way it was able to happen was that the campaign group For Women Scotland were able to take a case or raise a case against the Scottish government, because in the Scottish government's guidelines for an act from 2018, I think, their guidelines had said that sex, according to the Equality Act of 2010, meant gender identity, effectively. Now, that idea has been incorporated across the country in all sorts of ways, in schools, in corporations, in all sorts of companies, in the NHS, in government departments. So that misrepresentation of the law has become endemic, and someone had to challenge it in some way, and it fell to Four Women Scotland, who, you know, three women in Scotland, they've taken on the state. It's a really incredible story. And it could have gone either way. This was the really surprising thing about it. But of course, when that act was being penned in 2010, nobody at all who was involved would have ever suspected they weren't talking about biological sex. You know, that was clearly obvious. So they always had a good case in that respect. And they've won it. And it's now confirmed that not just that from now on, sex in the Equality Act means biological sex, but that it has always meant biological sex. So that's a really key point, I think, that they need to understand that the law has always been the case.
Yeah.
So when they've had six single-sex spaces for women and men who identify as women have been told they can go into those spaces, that actually isn't true. They weren't correct to do that, which is why, of course, there's a big backlash now. A lot of people are saying, but I've always done this.
Yeah.
But they were never actually legally permitted to do that. So this is so seismic because, well, firstly, it's great just to see the Supreme Court and the judiciary siding with biological reality.
Yeah.
Because, of course, as you know, in the Sal Grover case in Australia recently, we had a judge ruling that sex is changeable. That's the actual phrase that the judge used. Sex is changeable. It isn't. Whatever a judge says, it isn't. Whatever the law says, it isn't. And this is so important here because, of course, they'd created a legal fiction for the purposes of the Gender Recognition Act so that individuals can get a certificate. Individuals with gender dysphoria who have been diagnosed, they get a certificate, a GRC, a gender recognition certificate. And a lot of people were under the impression that if you had such a certificate, but you were male, but identified as female, and you were certified as such, you could then access female-only spaces. And this says that no, not even with that that legal fiction. So what it is the law acknowledging that no human being can change sex. And they've even introduced a new phrase, which is going to be very helpful, which is a certificated sex. So rather than saying legal sex, which I think complicates matters in people's heads, now we understand that there is such a thing as sex and also having a certificate for the legal fiction of sex. It's all very, very clear now. So there can't be any excuses when, you know, gyms and hospitals and prisons, etc., don't or refuse to segregate properly by sex. Now the law is very much on the side of women's rights. And I think it's a really important, massive decision, and I'm really thrilled that Four Women Scotland went through with it. You know, it's not easy to take on the government, but they did it and they won.
I mean, it's obviously, as you said, really important for women's rights, but also lesbians specifically. How would they have been affected had this not gone the right way?
Yeah, I mean, there were submissions during this case from the Lesbian Project, which is the group that's been set up by Kathleen Stock and Judy Bindle. From Scottish Lesbians, which is another group, LGB Alliance as well. So all of these gay rights groups were involved in submitting their views to the court. Very, very important that people understand that gender identity ideology is essentially anti-gay. What it believes is that homosexuality ought to be called homogenderism, I suppose.
Yeah.
That they believe that gay people are attracted not to bodies, but to an essence, a gendered essence, or even a certificate, which is absolutely preposterous. And of course, in Australia, you have a situation now where gay men and lesbians are not legally allowed to assemble or gather exclusively with each other.
Yeah.
If someone of the opposite sex who identifies differently demands to be part of that, you can't turn them away because that is against the law in Australia, according to discrimination. So that means there are no lesbian gatherings now in Australia. We don't have that now. So at the moment, according to the law, lesbians can gather and they can, you know, have their speed dating events as happened in London, except a man turned up demanding to get in. And this is a real issue for gay people. There are very good reasons why gay people want the right to assemble with other gay people.
Yeah.
Not just in terms of activism, but in terms of clubs and associations and that kind of thing. And they don't want members of the opposite sex there. And that is a perfectly reasonable thing. And it's really important as well that the government, or the judiciary rather, is standing behind gay people and saying, you know, yes, actually, your sexual orientation, you are attracted to members of your own sex, and that this ideology, which has been so pervasive and so powerful, doesn't get to completely undermine the bedrock of your rights, which is effectively what it was trying to do.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle with ultra titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time for water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates, not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
And there was that tremendous line in the judgment, which I believe they'd kind of picked up from Sex Matters or one of the other organizations that had been giving evidence to them that people don't have a sexual orientation towards a piece of paper, that just because someone's got a gender recognition certificate suggesting that they are female doesn't make that person a lesbian. And it was It was fascinating the way in which, obviously, first and foremost, this ruling is about trying to clarify the law. It's not about making pronouncements on the nature of reality and so on. It's just saying we have the Equality Act. It protects women's rights. It protects a series of fundamental rights. There has been this conflict which has been introduced by the Gender Recognition Act. There has been this confusion produced. But as they were thinking it through and coming to the conclusion very clearly and fairly that if you go down this road, then the Equality Act just becomes incoherent. I mean, what does it mean to protect the rights of pregnant women if you don't know what women are? What does it mean to protect the rights of lesbians if you don't believe in biological sex and so on and so forth? But in so doing, it just perfectly articulated and exposed the nonsense of the ideology in general. Mm. I mean, the idea that you can really have anything resembling gay rights or sex-based rights without recognizing sex as a fundamental biological category. So it just kind of exploded all of the nonsense that kind of lifted the spell in a really fascinating way. And the fact that this wasn't, you know, one can talk about the fact that you can't only change these things through the courts necessarily, although it's always going to be a factor when you're dealing with law. The fact that you had all of these gender critical groups who'd kind of come together as a part of this case, as a part of this litigation, who were almost arming the justices themselves with the arguments which then produced the judgment. You just really saw what a tremendous accomplishment the gender critical movement has achieved over the course of the past 20 years. You know, whilst being demonized, whilst being deplatformed, whilst being shouted down, whilst being physically assaulted in public for daring to assemble, that they have not only succeeded in clarifying the law, but they've also generated that genuine kind of civil society grassroots change, which has helped bring them to this particular point. I mean, I'm really in awe of what has happened here. Not in terms of it being a narrow legalistic ruling, but all that came before it to get us to this particular point.
Absolutely. Really important to stress, this is not just the wisdom of the judges being handed down. It is a result of that campaigning and that pushing.
Absolutely. I mean, I think Sex Matters have done incredible work and have faced a lot of, you know, flack for doing so. And in particular, I think what you say is so right, because we've got to remember that all of these predominantly women who fought this fight have not had the backing really of the political class or the media class. Mm. You know, I mean, we have a media class that talks about male rapists and murderers as female if they so identify, you know, it wants to respect their feelings. And Theresa May tried to bring in self-ID. The Labour Party and the Conservative Party have been completely enthralled to this ideology. And so they've been fighting back against incredible odds. But ultimately, they did have reality on their side, which is a really, really great thing. What they haven't had, and what's been very disappointing, I mean, we talk about gay rights, is that a lot of prominent gay celebrities have completely got this so wrong and have completely effectively acted on behalf of those who are against homosexuality, not fully understanding the situation. That's been really dispiriting.
While thinking they're allies.
Well, yeah, I mean, we've had, like, you know, a very good example. Well, lesbians are getting the particular brunt of this, because I don't go on lesbian dating sites, but I'm told that there is a significant proportion on all of these lesbian dating sites of men, often with beards, often with fully intact male genitalia. And, you know, some women are bisexual, fine, but these are lesbian dating sites.
Yeah.
They're not interested in male anatomy. They've opted out of that. And I say opted, it's not a choice. They're innately not attracted to men. And similarly with Grindr, which is a gay hookup site. You know, they, if you look on the website of Grindr, I'm not suggesting you do, but if you go on there, it, on their terms of service, they will say, well, you can filter out according to your various tastes, but you can't filter out women who identify as men. You can't do that because it says trans men are men and trans women are women. In other words, they're effectively trying to shame their gay clientele for being gay. And we also have had Stonewall, which was once the foremost gay rights charity in this country, now shaming gay people openly for being gay. You had Nancy Kelly, the former CEO, saying that women who were not attracted to people with penises should examine their prejudice. I mean, did she analogize them to sexual racists? So we have now this bizarre situation where people who claim to be progressive are on the side of anti-gay activists. You know, we even had activists releasing crickets, wasn't it?
Yeah, crickets.
Insects. At a gay rights conference, at the LGB Alliance conference in London. That's the kind of thing that neo-Nazis would do. That is, that, you know, trying to say that gay people are all like a plague. You know, that's what we're dealing with now. And Stonewall and Gendered Intelligence and Pink News and all the people who purport to stand up for gay rights are now deeply, profoundly anti-gay in a way that I didn't see when I was growing up, when homophobia was the norm. There wasn't anything like that, right? So that's the fight that these campaigners have had to push back against. Everyone against them, you know, massive misunderstandings across the board in terms of the media, in terms of the general public consciousness, in terms of politics. And yet they've still won because ultimately men and women are different and society has to be organized to a degree around those differences. And so reality prevails. And isn't that reassuring? Because you don't want the judiciary to have to solve everything.
We should talk a little bit about the reaction. There has been the most extraordinary meltdown from the usual suspects. Tom, I don't know if you want to speak to that a bit.
No, absolutely. India Willoughby isn't happy. Shocker. Various sort of trans activists aren't happy. They're trotting out this ridiculous line that their rights have been taken away from them. Another point that actually the judgment preempts when it says that, you know, in terms of rights under the Equality Act, those are all entirely intact. You just essentially can't take anyone else's rights. This isn't a zero-sum game. So all of that noise, that sound and fury is the sort of thing that we've come to expect. More interesting, I suppose, has been the response from the government, from the supposed centrist sensibles who have gone along with essentially the gender identity line for a very long time, essentially try to quietly back away from the crime scene, it feels like. It's the response has been on kind of encouraging but also pathetic at the same time. So we've had Bridget Phillipson, who on top of being the education secretary is the women and equalities brief for the government, put out a statement saying, quite literally, we've always been in favour of protecting sex-based rights on the basis of biology. It was very kind of, we've always been at war with East Asia sort of moment. And that's an indication, I think, of a lot of people, certainly within the government, recognising that the game is up. And I think probably an indication as well that this might, this is certainly not true for a lot of people in the Labour Party, but in terms of the people who've been humiliating themselves over recent years, Keir Starmer pontificating about what precise proportion of women may or may not have a penis, David Lammy kind of thinking out loud about how, under what medical conditions a man might be able to develop a cervix. I think a lot of that squirming was indicative of the fact that they weren't paid up ideologues. These weren't people who were spending their time kind of reading Judith Butler and the literature coming out of WPATH and being incredibly won over by this body of literature. They had just essentially outsourced their thinking to the activist groups. They had determined what was the high status opinion in this situation and just decided to repeat it ad nauseum. They were probably running scared of the various kind of LGBTQ question mark groups within their own party. But it didn't take much for the spell to start to break, I think, essentially. I mean, it's almost more depressing the fact that a lot of politicians have gone along with this nonsense, regardless of how misogynistic and homophobic it is, purely because they want to look good, you know, which is kind of what we've ended up with. That's almost more depressing in some senses. And I think it does reflect that our political class is really kind of given to various fads or manias of one type of another.
Yeah.
That because they don't have a lot of politics to them, because they don't really know why they're there, if, as soon as like transgenderism or critical race theory or climate alarmism or whatever it might be comes along, they sort of latch onto it unthinkingly because it gives them a kind of gloss of meaning, purpose, being a good person. But the nature of these manias is that people can drop them as quickly as that they've picked them up. That might, time will tell if that will actually be the case with this Labour Party. But I think it's indicative of, it was a very kind of brittle ideology as far as the ruling class was concerned. It felt very hard, but at the same time, it could shatter at any minute. And I hope that we're in the midst of one of those shattering.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle with ultra titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time for water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates, not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
I think that's so important. You know, I mean, like you say, you expect it from the Indu Willoughbys of the world and the fox-killing lawyer guy. Was it Morm?
Jolyon Morm.
Yeah, I mean, of course, these people are crazed ideologues, you know, so you don't expect a sensible response from them. But it's disturbing with the politicians because, like you say, some of them got so on board with this. Mm-hmm. And, is there going to be any soul-searching now? I mean, surely at this point, the Labour Party, Keir Starmer, needs to issue an apology to Rosie Duffield, first and foremost, who wasn't even able to go to the Labour Party conference because of security threats, because she was making the point that the Supreme Court has now ratified, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So there should be some sort of a gesture towards her and what happened with her. You've still got the crazed ideologues in the party, like Nadia Whittam, you know, like Lloyd Russell Moyle, is it?
Yeah.
You know, and they've been so vicious and bullying. And then Alicia Kearns on the Tory side, so wrong on this and so ill-informed. And when actually, if you were going to, you know, I don't mind people being ill-informed insofar as it's a complicated issue. You know, you can't be expected to read everything. But they were so vicious about the people who were dissenting. Mm-hmm. They should have, they have a responsibility to have read, to have understood the topic they were talking about, rather than just simply pontificating from a point of complete ignorance, which you had Alicia Kearns in Parliament going on about how trans women led the Stonewall riots and all sorts of stuff. She does not know what she's talking about. And these are really important issues, especially if you're going to start using this to bully various parliamentary peers. So I just wonder now what the government is going to do. I know Kimmy Badenoch is very thrilled with this result, and I know that the Tories have really come round to, you know, common sense. And I hope that Labour can do it. You say they're sort of backing away from the crime scene a bit, but now they need to do a lot of unpicking, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So there's going to be, there's questions of crime statistics. We don't know how many women and men are being arrested because a lot of the crime statistics are reported according to this spiritual gender identity thing, you know, the metaphysical beliefs of the perpetrators and the accused. Well, so we don't know. We don't know, I mean, how many men are currently in prison in the UK in women's prisons. That needs to be worked out. And not just men with a GRC, men full stop. Mm-hmm. And, you know, is that going to change now? Is there going to be someone in the government saying, no, actually, we do need to respect, and particularly in prisons where like so many of the women are so vulnerable, we really do need single sex spaces there. What about the NHS, which has been accommodating people according to gender identity to the extent that, you know, there was a sexual assault in London, the police turn up and the staff say, no, it couldn't have happened here. There were no men on that ward when they knew there were, but they had to say this because it was written in the NHS policy that they had to lie when it came to biological sex. Is all of this now going to get unpicked? What are the ramifications? What are the ramifications for all the schools that have allowed boys into girls' toilets?
Yeah.
You know, there has to be some repercussions. I get that people got it wrong because it was so confusing and the language was so confusing. And the phrases that the activists used were intended to obfuscate and to create confusion. You had the Labour Party supporting a ban on trans conversion therapy, not realising that that would effectively be in support of gay conversion therapy through the Tavistock and various things like that. So now, what with the Cass review, as well as the Supreme Court ruling, what is now going to happen? Are the Labour Party going to do anything to unpick all of the damage? It's going to take a long time. Yeah. That's the other thing. This isn't something that could be done overnight.
It does seem that some of those things are still going ahead. The trans conversion therapy thing, there's no sign of that being dropped. The BBC recently did a piece. There's been lots of polling around it. Very dodgy polling, claiming that 1 in 10 gay men have had an exorcism. So
not
they're
true.
Obviously trying to trying to stoke up this fear that there needs to be a conversion therapy ban. You know, we've had the Cass review, but what's that led to? There's going to be this giant, you know,
medical trial.
So basically everyone will be allowed to have it's going to circumvent the ban on puberty blockers. So you keep thinking, every time you think they've learned their lesson, every time you hear Wes Streeting or someone like that say something vaguely sensible, it just seems to creep back in.
What I hope will happen, maybe the most optimistic case where Labour are concerned, is that they will not get in the way of some of these things that slowly push back and pay it back. So like, for instance, in the wake of this ruling, you've got the Equality and Human Rights Commission, who have said they're really going to start putting pressure on the NHS now to actually reflect what this ruling has made absolutely clear, is that you cannot treat questions of sex separated care wards and so on as a question of identity and feeling and so on. You're also seeing the various gender critical groups who have, you know, who have experienced a few false dawns before committing themselves to pursuing other pieces of legislation, other policies which are in place. I know that Sex Matters are particularly interested in making sure that the police stop allowing trans identified males to search women, which is something which has been their policy up until now. Just today, I believe the British Transport Police have announced that as an interim measure in response to this ruling, it had some whoever is strip searching a suspect that has to be on the basis of biological sex. You're starting to see these kind of ripples. And even though I don't want to be kind of panglossing about it, and I don't think that Labour will be the administration that kind of purges the institutions and the statute book from any vestige of this nonsense and this hocus pocus, I think a reasonable scenario that we'll see is just them trying not to be seen to get in the way as other regulators, as other campaign groups, we'll let it kind of take its course towards a slightly saner settlement. It won't be perfect, but that's my hope, at least, even if it's not a given at this point that that's where we're headed.
Maybe, Tom, the problem is that at the moment, you know, we've got this recognition from the courts and politicians in a reluctant way that biological sex matters when it comes to sexual orientation, when it comes to women's rights. So that's sort of clarified. But what no one is talking about, and really this needs to be the next discussion, is what is gender identity? How are you defining it? You know, it is a quasi-religious belief. And people are entitled to their quasi-religious beliefs. I think that's perfectly fine. But the government and schools and hospitals and everyone and the police are forming policy on the basis of this esoteric belief system held by a tiny minority of the country, as though it's a thing. You know, so you saw Baroness Jackie Smith, in who's now the spokesperson for the government for equalities in the House of Lords, being asked directly, what is the government's working definition of gender identity? And she couldn't answer. I'm not surprised, because no one can answer. No one can give you a satisfactory definition of gender identity. Even trans activists themselves can't define this term. And yet this term, this concept, is the thing, the bedrock of all of this policy decision, right? So we're saying, let's accommodate people according to their gender identity. Let's change the way we organize society according to your gender identity. But nobody can define it, not even the people to whom it pertains. No one knows what it is other than this idea of a soul, a gendered soul, which doesn't exist. So I think we need some sort of, I don't know how, but I guess the politicians, someone has to be brave enough to say, this is not a thing. Right? It's just not a thing. Let people identify however they want.
Whatever. It's their private business.
Sure, there are some people who are only comfortable if they are presenting according to the traditional stereotypes of the opposite sex. And that's their right. You know, but they don't therefore have a right to say that this magically gives me the right to enter women's spaces. So that bit's been established. Now we have to have the guts to broach the elephant in the room, which is this notion of a gendered soul, an essence, whatever, a subconscious sex, I think one of the trans activists called it. Julia Serrano called it that. So we have to talk about that. We have to decide, you know, maybe scientific evidence will be proven that we do all have a gendered soul. I doubt it.
Yeah.
But you know, we have to have that investigation and discussion, I guess.
Yep.
But we don't do this for any other religious group. We do, or maybe we do, but, you know, we've still got religious people in the House of Lords. But, you know, we don't generally do this, and we haven't for a long time. So let's not carry on doing it. Are we going to have that conversation? I don't know. I don't know if that's going to happen.
I suppose one thing that is encouraging is that I think when it turns, in terms of fighting back against the gender ideology, but sort of just woke ideology in general, I really do think the TERFs have kind of shown everyone the way. Like, you need to be courageous. You need to be committed. You need to fight this on every conceivable front. You need to let those smears and those deplatformings bounce off you as hurtful and all the rest of it.
And
as
the
it
threats,
is. The threats. I mean, they've gone through much worse than, you know, many people who have been involved in many of these discussions have ever had to actually go through, because of the fact that when you've got reason on your side, reality on your side, the public on your side, you know, there's a certain point at which that becomes irresistible. Like, as long as the system isn't completely stacked against you entirely, you're going to get somewhere because you have right on your side. And I think that's an encouraging sign, not just for this debate, but for things in general, where reality has been warped by ideology in so many different places. There is an example here of how you fight back against all of that.
Definitely.
Well, what about globally, though? You know, this isn't the case in Australia. It certainly isn't the case in Canada. You know, I know, and in America, of course, now, the push for women's rights is seen as associated with the Trump administration. I mean, you had James O'Brien on LBC talking about how did you end up on the same side as Trump? And you just kind of think, yeah, well, I mean, that's such a infantile logic.
I think he thinks water's wet too, as well. You know,
I mean, look, the guy is just, I mean, it's incredible that he's got anywhere at all, because, you know, I mean, you could say this about, you remember when the BNP, when Nick Griffin supported Jeremy Corbyn, does he say to all his left-wing viewers, how did you end up on that side? You know, what I mean, it's so basic. But what do you do globally? Is it the case that this will ripple out, that as you say, the beacon of reason, because they do have reason on their side, that in a sense, the UK can lead the way on this? Is it going to happen that way?
I think it's a big victory for Turf Island, definitely.
Beacon to the world, we hope. But we shall see.
So Hashim Abedi, the terrorist who was convicted alongside his brother Salman as responsible for the Manchester Arena bombing, has been involved in a prison attack. He and some others essentially attacked a number of guards with makeshift knives and threw boiling hot water over some of them. Tom, how the hell was this allowed to happen? Someone like Hashim Abedi is, you know, someone who you would think would have all eyes on him every second of the day.
No, it's a spectacular failure of security within the prison system. He was in HMP Frankland. He somehow managed to get his hands on materials that he could sharpen up into knives. Effectively, he did throw this hot, I've seen cooking oil, also seen water reported. Whatever it is, it's done a horrendous amount of damage to three prison guards. They were inflicted with life-threatening injuries. Thankfully, they've all managed to make it through. How he was ever allowed access to any of this to begin with is crazy. Also, this isn't the first time he's attacked people in prison. I mean, it was a few years ago now where he and a couple of other Islamists had also attacked, in a kind of frenzied attack, a prison officer. And also, he's one of, if not the most high profile Islamist terrorist in the prison estate.
Yeah.
I mean, he's been moved to Belmarsh now. Why he wasn't there to begin with, I have absolutely no idea. He's serving, what, 55 years in prison for the role that he played with his now deceased brother Salman in the Manchester Arena horror. It really speaks to the sort of profound naivety, complacency of the British state, I guess. And what's particularly chilling is that that goes back throughout the whole story of the Abedis, really. I mean, the reason that they ended up in the UK in the first place was because his father, who was a sort of Libyan Islamist opponent of the Gaddafi regime, claims asylum here in the 1990s, where the Abedi children are born. When they start to come of age, Salman, Hashem, and also there's another brother called Ismail, clearly begin to show signs of radicalization. Hashem and Salman travel back and forth to Libya during the Libyan civil war, where they were clearly fighting with Islamist militias, learning how to shoot guns, learning how to build bombs. They were able to travel back to Britain entirely unchecked. I believe at one point even the British Navy intervened to bring them back when they got caught in a sticky situation while they were out there. Also, with the inquiries that went on into Manchester Arena, MI5 having to formally apologize because they found information that they didn't act upon in a timely enough fashion to stop that horrendous bombing from taking place, you just feel like from top to bottom, there has been this willful, perhaps not so willful, unwitting kind of naivety towards this particular family, which has led to not only, 22 people losing their life back in 2017 on that horrendous night, but also now, even prison guards just trying to do their job, finding themselves, you know, slashed at and scalded because the state still hasn't learned its lesson. So just from top to bottom, I find it incredible.
Andrew, one of the sort of patterns or themes that we often see is that when it comes to Islamists, the state just sort of recoils. It's like,
yeah,
it's not that I'm not going to say that he's been given a soft touch because he's been given 55 years in prison, but there is something about the way that why has he, you know, someone responsible for one of the worst attacks on children,
yeah,
and yet is still not in a complete maximum security prison.
Well, I think, as Tom says, it does speak to a broader problem. And, you know, there are all sorts of problems with Islamist gangs within prisons, forcing other inmates to convert and threatening them with their life if they don't. It sounds like that is not being tackled. You know, we don't know the full extent of the problem, but we know that it is a problem and it's very, very serious. And there is a general sense, isn't there, that the Islamist threat is just not really taken seriously or is not does not receive the attention that it requires because of this fear of being accused of being racist. I think that's ultimately what it is. MI5, I think it's 75% of MI5's work is taken up on the threat from Islamist terrorists. And yet we are continually told that the problem is the far right, is white nationalists and that kind of thing. I'm not saying they're not a problem. Yeah. They're definitely a problem, but they're nowhere near the problem that the radical Islamism is. Same in Germany. You know, the politicians are continually saying that the far right is the problem. When people are getting stabbed every week, like by Islamists, so people can see that this is a problem, and no one wants to tackle it. Now, why is that? I mean, I think there's the intersectional element. There's a sense in which Muslims are high up on the oppression hierarchy, and therefore we mustn't offend them. But God, that to me is more offensive to Muslims because you're basically saying that you should be defined by the worst aspects within your community. You know, I think ultimately this has to be dealt with. People have to take the threat of radical political Islamism very, very seriously because these are people who think that there's nothing better, nothing more glorious than murder, than mass murder, and they will continue to do this. So I think all of this stuff with this guy in prison and their failure to sort of really reckon with it does speak to a much bigger problem of in the West, of us failing to deal with this issue.
Yeah.
Because either we're too afraid, because obviously the ramifications can be very violent, very unpleasant, but also that we don't want to admit that there is clearly a problem going on. And if we address it, like with the grooming gang situation, we might be accused of being racist all over again. It's not good enough.
Yeah, people would rather cover up or ignore the threat than confront it directly.
And like hiding in plain sight doesn't cover it where the Abadis are concerned. You know, they were the children of himself, a kind of radical Islamist militia man. There were various points in which, as I say, they were travelling back and forth to Libya during the civil war. Various reports coming from particularly Salman Abedi's school where he was beating up girls because of the length of their skirt. There was widely expressed concerns that he'd clearly been radicalised towards ISIS in particular. And yet, time and again, these aren't even red flags. These are huge, you know, signals going up that something was wrong here, and yet it wasn't addressed.
So why does that happen? I mean, why is it the case that you can have some? I mean, this guy went to Libya twice, didn't he? Mm-hmm. Right. So fighting with Islamists, right? So I mean, I love the tradition of Britain taking in people seeking asylum in need, right? But at what point do you say, actually, let's not take in criminals? Let's not take in people who are associating with Islamist terrorists. You know, surely that should be a kind of... I mean, you can see what's happened in Sweden. This is exactly what's happened, is there hasn't been a robust form of liberalism applied. So they've sort of just... I mean, there was that guy in Sweden who attacked that 91-year-old woman, almost killed her. And they, you know, he'd committed multiple crimes since receiving asylum in Sweden, including going to prison for rape. At what point do you say, okay, you can go then? We don't want you in this country because you're a criminal and a would-be a rapist and killer of old women. Like, so I just don't understand this idea that you would not robustly vet and demand high standards from people seeking asylum. Mm-hmm. You know, there should be those standards applied in terms of you're going to have to assimilate. Yeah. You know, when you go to America and become a citizen, you have to learn about the history of the country and pass a test, right? I think our test should be, you shouldn't be a criminal and you shouldn't be involved with a terrorist group. Is that too much to ask?
Is that really so high a bar?
Not really.
Crazy.
Yeah. Well, speaking of America, Andrew, you've been visiting America a lot, speaking of that country, since leaving GB News. Tell us a bit about what you've been up to, first of all.
Yeah, well, I'm hoping eventually to relocate there. I want to work there. I've been writing a new sitcom with Graham Linehan, and we've been, our hope is that we can get that produced ultimately in America. We're working on a company with Rob Schneider in Arizona. So hopefully that will all happen. Mm. And as a result, I've been spending a lot of time out there in America, and it is a very different feel. Obviously, if you read just the media from America at the moment, you would think that the whole country is falling apart.
Yeah.
And it's all very, very disastrous. And wherever you stand on the Trump administration, it's not as bad as the media is making out. There's that sort of crazed thing going on with people vandalizing Teslas and all that sort of stuff, which feels to me like a kind of delayed response, because we didn't get the meltdown after the election that we all expected. Yeah. But now we're getting it, and they think that, because someone on the internet told them that Elon Musk is a Nazi, that gives them the right to break the law. It's absolutely bizarre. But I think there is something happening, which I'm noticing. When I talk to Americans about what's going on in the UK, they really can't believe it. Mm. Whether they're on the left or the right, they cannot believe that people are being arrested, imprisoned for tweets.
Yeah.
They don't get, it's not a partisan issue over there, because they have a First Amendment. Although we've got the great tradition of free speech, we've got our common law tradition. We've got,
They kind of inherited it from us, if you want to.
Right. Exactly. We've got Milton in the background. You can't see it. It'll be blurry, but,
Exactly. We've got Milton, Mill, Locke, the Three Johns, We've got all of that. They cannot understand how it is that we have lost our way on free speech so much. And I do think there's a interesting new front in the culture war opening up between America and Europe, which feels like a kind of Henry James novel for our times, the old world against the new, which is why when J.D. Vance went to the Munich Security Conference, that the European leaders were just baffled that he was trying to defend free speech. I think there is and of course our Labour government is doubling down 100% on their anti-free speech authoritarian approach. And even to the extent that Trump is basically saying, you better get that in order, or I'm not going to do a trade deal with you, which I think a lot of us will have our reservations about. So that front is opening up now. And I think that's going to be the next aspect of the culture war that's going to be very interesting, is who is going to win that? Who's going to win that ultimate battle? And I don't think it's a left-right issue. And I don't think it's a pro-Trump or anti-Trump issue either. I think that principle of free speech is so embedded in America. But for whatever reason, in this country, it's sort of gone. I mean, with the Lucy Connolly case, for instance, I've been shocked by all the various people who, I consider sensible on so many issues, saying, well, she shouldn't have said that, so 31 months in prison, that seems fair. Yeah. It's like, what are you talking about? No one in America, left or right, would think that that was anything other than mental. And why are you even having this debate? But here, it seems like we have to win that argument all over again. Mm. And we could probably do a lot worse than look to America and look to trying to get an equivalent of the First Amendment, something that guarantees our rights.
That would stop you being put in prison for two years and 7 months.
Yeah. For a tweet.
For a tweet. Yeah.
It's insane.
And Ian Akerson pointed this out on the site the other week. There was actually a rioter in Southport who was involved in throwing bricks at police, who was targeting the mosque. He got a lesser sentence than Lucy Connolly. You just think that in and of itself is the crazy. What's the sitcom about though, Andrew? It's not about a cancelled sitcom writer and a plucky satirist.
No, it is not.
Making their way in America, or is it something else?
We didn't want to. I mean, this is something that Graham was very keen that we didn't write an anti-woke sitcom, because that will date very quickly. Yeah. The way that the culture war always does. So it's not about that. I don't know how much I'm allowed to say about what it's about, but it will address those issues kind of on the periphery. Mm-hmm. It's really just going to be a comedy that's funny. but that's the priority. That's what we're trying to achieve.
It's quite radical to do something not political now, or to not have a message that you're beating someone over the head with.
Exactly. And particularly for Graham, because he hasn't been able to work in the industry for 6 years. So you'd imagine the impulse is, let's write a show that attacks all the people who attacked him. But that's not what we're doing. And, it's brilliant for him being the lead writer on this thing, because he hasn't been able to work for so long. And, I do feel, I suppose working with American people and American companies and people like Rob, and, you might say, well, why am I running away and doing it in America or what, but I feel like there are more creative opportunities at the moment in America, at the moment. I'm not saying that's a permanent thing. But it is the case that the arts industry, the comedy industry in the UK is completely captured by this stuff. to an extent that it's really unlikely that you're going to get anything particularly innovative, subversive, or interesting anytime soon in this country. That's not really happening.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're getting Saturday Night Live UK soon, which I think will not be right. Particularly
so subversive. What will that be like? Yeah. You know, that will just be more of the kind
is
of
Nish Kumar's phone ringing somewhere.
Right, there we go. Yeah. It's going to be the orthodoxy. It's going to be the establishment all over again. It's so boring. And although that does go on in America, don't get me wrong. I mean, you know, Saturday Night Live has very much been gone down that establishment route with some terrible sketches that just basically parrot out the establishment view. But, you know, I do think there are more opportunities over there to do stuff because I think Americans just like things that make money and they're very kind of cynical like that. And that's probably it. But at the moment, I mean, look, you know, at the last Edinburgh Fringe, the Comedy Awards, the speech that was given by Nika Burns, who's head of the awards, she was just boasting about how there's very few male identified people on the shortlist. You know, we've got all these queer sexualities and all that. Mm-hmm. Like, you're a comedy award. Mm. Give the award to the funniest act. But they haven't done that for ages. They've given it according to identity categories and politics, right? Well, you know, so fine, you know, we'll make it an award for diversity, you know, fine. But don't call it a comedy award when it clearly isn't. So I do think the industry here is just so in such a terrible way. So we'll see. We'll see whether things can change. Hopefully.
No.
Hopefully the vibe shift comes over here.
Absolutely. Maybe.
And we look forward to the sequel.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for watching the Spiked podcast. We'll be back the same time next week. In the meantime, why not subscribe to Spiked's YouTube channel and then click the bell so you're always alerted whenever there's some new content. Spiked is producing more videos than ever, from podcasts like this one to interviews to our series of polemics. You really, really don't want to miss out on it. Plus, to get your daily dose of Spiked, just go to spiked-online.com. That's our website at spiked-online.com.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.